folks. Not a fatal impact, but one you'd prefer to skip. Up came the racket again. The wood rim descended like a blade, too swift this time to evade. I took the brunt of it on my left forearm, raised instinctively to shield my face. The racket connected with a cracking sound. The blow was like a white flash of heat up my arm. I can't say I felt pain. It was more like a jolt to my psyche, unleashing aggression. I caught her in the mouth with the heel of my hand, knocking her back into him. The two of them went down with a mingled yelp of surprise. The air around me felt white and empty and clean. I grabbed her shirt with an unholy strength, hauling her to her feet. Without any thought at all, I punched her once, registering an instant later the smacking sound as my fist connected with her face. Somebody snagged my arm from behind. The desk clerk was hanging on to me, screaming incoherently. My left hand was still knotted in Elva's shirt. She tried to backstroke out of range, arms flailing as she yodeled with fear, eyes wide. My self-control reasserted itself, and I lowered my fist. She fairly crowed with relief, staring at me with astonishment. I don't know what she'd seen in my face, but I knew what I'd seen in hers. I felt giddy with power, happiness surging through me like pure oxygen. There's something about physical battle that energizes and liberates, infusing the body with an ancient chemistry, a cheap high with a sometimes deadly effect. A blow to the face is as insulting as you can get, and there's no predicting what you'll garner in return. I've seen petty barroom disputes end in death over a slap on the cheek. Her mouth was already puffy, her teeth washed with blood. Exhilaration peaked and drained at the sight. Now I could feel pain throb in my arm, and I bent with the pulse of it, panting hard. The bruise was a sharp blue vertical line, red welt spreading its blood cloud under the skin. I would swear I could see a raised line where the gut had been strung along the edge of the racket. Set upon by an evil-tempered tennis buff. It was also damn dumb. Lucky I hadn't interrupted her at a round of golf. She'd have pounded me to a pulp with her pitching wedge. My knuckles were stinging where the skin had ripped. I hoped her rabies vaccinations were up to date. Elva began to cry piteously, adopting the victim stance when it was she who had tried to savage me. I felt something stir, and I yearned to go after her again. But the truth was I hurt, and the need to tend to myself took precedence. Dr. Dunn shepherded his wife into his office. The desk clerk in the orange blazer scurried after them, while I leaned against the wall, trying to catch my breath. He might have been calling the sheriff's department, but I didn't much care. In a moment the doctor returned, full of soothing apologies and solicitous advice. All I wanted was to get the hell out of there, but he insisted on examining my arm, assuring me it wasn't broken. God, did the man think I was an idiot? Of course it wasn't broken. He steered me into the hotel infirmary, where he cleaned my battered hand. He was clearly worried, and that interested me more than anything that had transpired so far.
"I'm sorry you and Elva had a falling out."
He dabbed a stinging disinfectant on my hand, his gaze flicking quickly to my face to see if I'd react. I said,
"You know women, we get into these little tiffs."
The irony was apparently lost on him.
"She's protective. I'm sure she didn't mean to offend. She was so upset I had to give her a sedative."
"I hope you've got all your hand tools locked up. I'd hate to see the lady with a crescent wrench." He began to put his first aid supplies away.
"I think we should try to forget the incident."
"Easy for you to say," I said. I was flexing my right hand, admiring the way the butterfly band-aid closed the cleft in my knuckle formed by Elva's front teeth.
"I take it you still won't give me information on Jean Timberlake?"
He had crossed the room to the sink where he was washing his hands, his back turned.
"I saw her that day," he said tonelessly. "I explained as much to the police at the time."
"The day she was killed?"
"That's right. She came to my office when she got the results of her pregnancy test."
"Why not have you run the test to begin with?"
"I couldn't tell you that. Perhaps she was embarrassed about the predicament she was in. She said she'd pleaded with the Lompoc doctor to abort her. He'd turned her down, and I was next on her list."
He dried his hands thoroughly and hung the towel on the rack.
"And you refused?"
"Of course."
"Why, of course?" "Aside from the fact that back then abortion was illegal, it's something I would never do. Her mother survived an illegitimate pregnancy. No reason this girl couldn't have done the same. The world doesn't end, though she didn't seem to see it that way. She said it would ruin her life, but that simply wasn't true.
While he talked, he unlocked a cabinet and took out a big jar of pills. He shook five into a small white envelope, which he handed to me.
What are these? Tylenol with codeine.
I couldn't believe I'd need painkillers, but I tucked the envelope in my handbag. In my line of work, I get bashed around a lot.
Did you tell Jean's mother what was going on?
Unfortunately, no. Jean was a minor, and I should have informed her mother, but I agreed to keep the matter confidential. I wish now I'd spoken up. Maybe things would have turned out differently.
And you have no idea who Jean's father was?
I'd try ice on that arm, he said. If the swelling persists, come back and see me. At the office, if you don't mind. There'll be no charge.
Did she give you any indication who she was involved with?
Dr. Dunn left the room without another word.
I scrounged a long-sleeved shirt out of the back seat of my car and pulled it on over my T-shirt so the rainbow of bruises on my arm wouldn't show. I sat there for a moment, leaning my head back against the seat, trying to marshal my forces for whatever was coming next. I was done in. It was only 4 o'clock, and I felt as if the day had gone on forever. So many things bothered me. Tap with his shotgun shells loaded with rock salt, the $42,000 unaccounted for. Someone was maneuvering, slipping in and out like a dim figure in the fog. I had caught glimpses, but there was no way to identify the face. I pulled myself upright and started the car, heading into town again so I could talk to Royce. I found the hospital on Johnson, just a few blocks from the high school. The architecture chunky and nondescript. No design awards for this one. Royce was on the medical surgical floor. The soles of my boots squeaked faintly against the highly polished vinyl tiles. I passed the nurse's station, following the room numbers. Nobody paid any attention to me as I made my way down the hall, averting my eyes when I passed an open door. The sick, the injured, and the dying have very little privacy as it is. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see that most of them lay abed in a cluster of flower arrangements, get-well cards propped open, their television sets on. I could smell green beans. Hospitals always smell like canned vegetables to me. I came to Royce's room. I paused just outside the door and disconnected my feelings. I went in. Royce was asleep. He looked like a captive, sides pulled up around his bed, an IV like a tether connecting him to a pole. A clear blue plastic oxygen cone covered his nose. The only sound was the breath whiffling through his lips in an intermittent snore. His teeth had been taken away from him, lest he bite himself to death. I stood by the bed and watched him. He'd been sweating, and his white hair was lank, plastered in long strands across his forehead. His hands lay palms up on the covers, large and raw, fingers twitching now and then. Was he dreaming, like a dog, of his hunting days? In a month he'd be gone. This ornery mass of protoplasm, driven by countless irritations, by dreams, by desires unfulfilled. I wondered if he'd live long enough to have what he wanted most, his son, Bailey, whose fate he'd entrusted to my care.
Chapter 18. At 5:30 I was knocking on Shanna Timberlake's door, already convinced there was no one home. Her battered green Plymouth was no longer in the drive. The cottage windows were dark, and the drawn front curtains had that blank look of no occupancy. I tried the knob without luck, always interested in the notion of an unsupervised inspection of the premises, a specialty of mine. I did a quick detour around to the back, checking the rear door. She'd put a second bag of trash out, but I could see through the kitchen window that the dirty dishes were piling up again, and the bed was unmade. The place looked like a flophouse. I went back to the motel. What I wanted most in the world was to lay my little head down and go to sleep, but I couldn't see a way to pull that off. I had too much work to do, too many troubling questions yet to ask. I stepped into the office. As usual, the desk was unmanned, but I could hear Ori on the telephone in the family living room. I slipped under the counter and knocked politely on the door frame. She glanced up, catching sight of me, and motioned me in. She was taking reservations for a family of five, negotiating a sofa bed, a crib, and a cot, with variations in the room rate.
Maxine, the cleaning lady, had come and gone with very little evidence of her effectiveness. All she'd done, as far as I could see, was to clear off a few surfaces, leaving a residue of furniture oil in which dust was settling. The counterpane on Ori's hospital bed was now littered with junk mail, news clippings and old magazines, along with that mysterious collection of coupons and flyers that seems to accumulate on end tables everywhere. The wastebasket beside the bed was already spilling over. Ori was idly sorting and discarding as she talked. She concluded her business and set the telephone aside, fanning herself with a windowed envelope.
"Ah, Kinsey, what a day it's been. I think I'm coming down with something. Lord only knows what. Everybody I talk to has the 24-hour flu. I feel so achy all over, and my head's about to bust."
"I'm sorry to hear that," I said. "Is Anne around?"
"She's inspecting some rooms. Every time we get a new maid, we have to check and double-check, making sure the job's done right. Of course, the minute one's trained, off she goes again, and you have to start from scratch." "Well, look at you. What did you do to your hand there? Poke it through a window screen?"
I glanced at my knuckles, trying to think of a convincing fib. I didn't think I'd been hired to punch out the local doctor's wife. Bad form, and I was embarrassed now that I'd lost control of myself. Fortunately, my ills were of only passing interest, and before I could answer, she was back to her own. She scratched at her arm.
"I've got this rash," she said, mystified. "Can you see them little bumps? Itch? It's like to drove me insane. I never heard of any kind of flu like that, but I don't know what else it could be, do you?"
She held her arm up. I peered dutifully, but all I could see were the marks she'd made while clawing at herself. She was the kind of woman who would launch any minute into a long monologue about her bowels, thinking perhaps that her flatulence had some power to fascinate. How Anne Fowler survived in this atmosphere of medical narcissism was beyond me. I glanced at my watch. "Oh, gee, I better get upstairs."
"Well, I'm not going to let you do that. You sit right down here and visit," Ori said. "With Royce gone and my arthritis acting up, I don't know where my manners have went. We never had a chance to get to know one another."
She patted the side of the bed as if I might be a lucky pup, allowed at last on the furniture.
"I wish I could, Ori, but you know I have to—" "Oh, no, you don't. It's after 5 o'clock and not even supper time yet. Why would you have to run off at this hour?"
My mind went blank. I stared at her mutely, unable to think of any plausible excuse. I have a friend named Leo who became phobic about old ladies after one wrapped a turd in waxed paper and put it in his trick-or-treat bag. He was 12 at the time and said that aside from spoiling Halloween for him, it ruined all his candy corn. He never could trust old folks after that. I'd always been fond of the elderly, but now I was developing much the same distaste. Anne appeared in the doorway, a clipboard in hand. She shot me a distracted look.
"Oh, hello, Kinsey. How are you?"
Ori launched right in, not wanting to let anybody else establish a conversational beachhead. She held her arm out again.
"Anne, honey, look at this here. Kinsey says she's never seen anything like this in her life."
Anne gave her mother a look.
"Could you just wait a minute, please?"
Ori didn't seem to pick up on the prickliness.
"You're going to have to go to the bank first thing in the morning. I paid Maxine out of petty cash and there's hardly anything left."
"What happened to the 50 I gave you yesterday?"
"I just told you. I paid Maxine with that."
"You paid her $50? How long was she here?"
"Well, you needn't take that tone. She come at 10 and didn't leave till 4, and she never sat down once except to eat her lunch."
"I bet she ate everything in sight." Ori seemed offended.
"I hope you don't begrudge the poor woman a little bite of lunch."
"Mother, she worked 6 hours. What are you paying her?" Ori, uneasy on this point, began to pluck at the covers.
"You know her son has been sick, and she says she doesn't see how she can keep cleaning for $6 an hour. I told her we could go to 7.
"You gave her a raise?"
"Well, I couldn't very well tell her no."
"Why not? That's ridiculous. She's slow as molasses, and she does shitty work."
"Well, pardon me, I'm sure. What's wrong with you?"
"Nothing's wrong. I've got problems enough. The rooms upstairs were a mess, and I had to do 2 of them again." Ori cut in.
"That's no reason to snap at me. I told you not to hire the girl. She looked like some kind of foreigner with that black hair braided down the back."
Why do you do this? The minute I walk in the door, you're all over me. I've asked you to give me time to catch my breath, but oh no, whatever you want is the most important thing in the world.
Ori shot me a look. This was the kind of treatment a sick old woman was subjected to.
I was just trying to help, she said, her voice quavering.
Oh, stop that, Anne said. She left the room in exasperation. A moment later we could hear her in the kitchen banging drawers and cabinet doors.
Ori wiped at her eyes, making certain I noticed how upset she was.
I have to make a phone call, I murmured, and eased out of the room before she could enlist my support.
I went upstairs, feeling out of sorts. I had never worked for such unpleasant people in my life. I locked myself in my room and lay down on the bed, too exhausted to move and too unsettled to sleep. The tensions of the day were piling up, and I could feel my head begin to pound from the lack of sleep. Belatedly, I realized I'd never eaten lunch. I was starving.
God, I said aloud.
I got out of bed, stripped, and headed for the shower. 15 minutes later, I was dressed in fresh clothes and on my way out. Maybe a decent dinner would help get me back on track. It was absurdly early, but I never eat at a fashionable hour anyway, and in this town the concept would be wasted. Floral Beach has a choice of restaurants. There's the Pizza Parlor on Palm Street, and on Ocean there's the Breakwater, the Galleon, and the Ocean Street Cafe, which is open for breakfast only. A line was already forming outside the Galleon. I gathered the early bird special drew crowds from as far away as 2 blocks. The sign indicated family-style dining, which means no booze is served and there are shrieking kids on booster seats banging spoons. I pushed into the Breakwater, heartened by the notion of a full bar. The interior was a mix of nautical and early American. Maple captain's chairs, blue and white checked cloths on the tables, candles in fat red jars encased in the kind of plastic webbing it's fun to fiddle with while you talk. Above the bar, fishing nets were draped across the wooden spokes of a ship's wheel. The hostess was dressed in a mock pilgrim's costume, which consisted of a long skirt and a tight bodice with a low-cut neckline. She had apparently donned an early American push-up bra because her perky little breasts were forced together like 2 patty pan squash. If she leaned over too far, one was going to pop right out. A couple of guys at the bar kept an eye on her, hoping against hope. Aside from those two, the place was nearly deserted, and she seemed relieved to have some business. She seated me in the no-smoking section, which is to say, between the kitchen and the payphone. The menu she handed me was oversized, bound with a tasseled cord, and featured steak and beef. Everything else was deep-fried. I was wrestling with the choice of plump shrimp lightly battered and served with our chef's own secret sauce, spelled S-A-U-S-E, or tender sea scallops, batter-coated, lightly sautéed and served with a zesty sweet and sour dip. When Dwight Shales materialized at my table, he looked as if he'd showered and changed clothes, too, in preparation for a big hot night on the town.
"I thought that was you," he said. "Mind if I sit down?"
"Be my guest," I said, indicating the empty seat. "What's the story here? Should I have eaten at the Galleon?" He pulled out a chair and sat down.
"The same people own both."
"Well, then how come the line's so long over there and this place is empty?"
"Because it's Thursday, and the Galleon offers free barbecued ribs as an appetizer. The service is always lousy, so you're not missing anything."
I surveyed the menu again. "What's good here?"
"Not much. All the seafood is frozen, and the chowder comes out of cans. The steak is passable. I order the same thing every time I come. Filet mignon, medium rare, with a baked potato, tossed salad with blue cheese, and apple pie for dessert. If you have 2 martinis up front, you'll think it's the 4th best meal you ever ate. Up from that is any quarter pounder with cheese."
I smiled. He was flirting, a hitherto unsuspected aspect of his personality. "You're joining me, I hope."
"Thanks, I'd like that. I hate to eat alone."
"Me too." The waitress appeared and we ordered drinks. I confess I was curing my fatigue with a martini on the rocks, but it was quick and efficient, and I enjoyed every minute of it. While we talked, I did a covert assessment of him. It interests me how people's looks change as you get to know them. The first flash is probably the most accurate, but there are occasions when a face undergoes a transformation that seems almost magical. With Dwight Shales, there seemed to be a more youthful persona submerged in a 55-year-old shell. His hidden self was becoming more visible to me as he talked. I listened with both eyes and one ear, trying to discern what was really going on. Ostensibly, we were discussing how we spent our leisure time. He gravitated toward backpacking, while I tended to amuse myself with the abridged California Penal Code and textbooks on auto theft. While his mouth made noises about an assault of ticks on a recent day hike, his eyes said something else. I disconnected my brain and fine-tuned my receiver, picking up his code. This man was emotionally available. That was the subliminal message. A chunk of lettuce dropped off my fork, and my mouth closed on the bare tines. Ever the sophisticate. I tried to act as though I preferred to eat my salad that way. Midway through the meal, I changed the tenor of the conversation, curious what would happen if we talked about something personal. What happened to your wife? I take it she died.
Multiple sclerosis. She went into remission numerous times, but it always caught up with her. 20 years of that shit. Toward the end, she couldn't do anything for herself. She was luckier than most, if you want to look at it that way. Some patients are rapidly incapacitated, but Karen wasn't in a wheelchair until the last 16 months or so.
I'm sorry. It sounds grim.
He shrugged. It was. Sometimes it looked like she had it licked. Long period, symptom-free.
The hell of it was she was misdiagnosed early on. She'd been plagued by minor health problems, so she started seeing a local chiropractor for what she thought was gout. Of course, once he got hold of her, he mapped out a whole bullshit program that only postponed her getting real help.
Class 3 subluxation, that's what he said it was. I should have sued his ass off, but what's the point?
She wasn't a patient of Dr. Dunn's by any chance. He shook his head.
I finally forced her to see an internist in town, and he referred her to UCLA for a workup. I guess it didn't matter in the final analysis. Things probably would have come out the same either way. She handled it much better than I did, that's for sure.
I couldn't think of a thing to say to him. He talked about her for a while, and then went on to something else. May I ask you about your relationship with Shanna Timberlake?
He seemed to debate briefly.
Sure, why not? She's become a good friend. Since my wife died, I've spent a lot of time with her. I'm not having an affair with the woman, but I do enjoy her company.
I know tongues in town are wagging, but to hell with it. I'm too old to worry about that sort of thing anymore.
Have you seen her today? I've been trying to track her down.
No, I don't think so.
I looked over to see Ann Fowler coming in the door.
Oh, there's Ann, I said.
Dwight turned and caught her eye, motioning to her with pleasure. As she approached, he got up and borrowed a chair from a nearby table and moved it over to ours. The dark mood was still with her. She radiated tension, her mouth looking pinched. If Dwight was aware of it, he gave no sign. He held her chair.
Would you like a drink?
Yes, sherry. She signaled for the waitress before he had a chance. He sat down again. I noticed she was avoiding eye contact with me.
And drinking? That seemed odd.
Have you eaten? I asked. You could have told me you wouldn't be with us for dinner tonight. I felt my cheeks heat at her tone.
I'm sorry. It didn't even occur to me. I was going to take a nap when it dawned on me I hadn't eaten all day. I took a quick shower and came straight over here. I hope I didn't put you out.
She didn't bother to reply to that. I could see that unconsciously she'd adopted her mother's strategy, hanging on to her martyrdom and milking it. I'm not crazy about this as a mode of interaction. The waitress arrived and asked Ann what she wanted. Before she disappeared, Dwight snagged the woman's attention.
Hi, Dorothy. Has Shanna Timberlake been in today?
Nope, not that I've seen. She's usually here for lunch, but she may have gone into San Luis. Thursday's her day to shop.
Well, if you see her, tell her to give me a buzz, if you would.
Will do.
Dorothy moved away from the table, and he turned back to us.
How are you, Dwight?
Ann said with forced pleasantness. It was clear she was cutting me right out of the loop. I was too tired to play games. I finished my coffee, tossed a 20 on the table, and excused myself.
You're leaving us? Dwight said with a quick look at his watch. It's not even 9:30.
It's been a long day, and I'm beat. We went through our good-night maneuvers, Anne being only minimally more polite than she had been. Her sherry arrived as I left the table and headed for the door. I thought Dwight seemed slightly disappointed at my departure, but I might have been kidding myself. Martinis bring out the latent romantic in me. Also headaches, if anybody's interested.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
Chapter 19. The night was clear. The moon was a pale gold, with gray patches forming patterns across the face of it like bruises on a peach. The door to Pearl's pool hall was standing open as I passed, but there were no pool players in evidence, and just a handful of people at the bar. The jukebox was playing a country-western tune of some haunting melodic sort. There was one couple on the dance floor, the woman stony-faced as she looked over the man's shoulder. He was doing a hip-swaying two-step, moving her in a circle while she pivoted in place. I slowed, recognizing them from the arraignment, Pearl's son and daughter-in-law. On an impulse, I went in. I perched on a bar stool and turned so I could watch them. He seemed self-absorbed. She was bored. They reminded me of one of those middle-aged couples I see in restaurants whose interest in one another has long ago expired. He was wearing a tight white T-shirt that bowed slightly at the waist where his love handles bulged out. His jeans were low-slung, too short for the heel on his cowboy boots. His hair was a curly blonde, damp from all the styling mousse, which I had to guess was going to smell as pungent as buffalo musk. His face was smooth and full, with a pug nose, a sulky mouth, and an expression that suggested he was very smitten with himself. This guy spent a lot of time in front of bathroom mirrors, combing his hair while he decided which side of his mouth to hang his cigarette from. Daisy approached, her gaze following mine. "That's Pearl's son and daughter-in-law?" "Yep, Rick and Sherry." "Happy-looking pair. What's he do?" "A welder at a company makes storage tanks. He's an old friend of Tap's. She works for the telephone company, or at least she did. She quit a couple of weeks back, and they've been squabbling ever since. Want a beer?" "Sure, why not?" Pearl was on the far end of the room in a conversation with a couple of guys in bowling shirts. He nodded when he saw me, and I gave him a wave. Daisy brought my beer in a frosty mason jar. The dance number ended. Sherry left the dance floor, with Rick close behind. I put a couple of bucks on the bar and crossed to their table just as they sat down. Close up, her features were delicate, her blue eyes set off by dark lashes and brows. She might have been pretty if she'd had the resources. As it was, she was thin in a way that spoke of poor nutrition. Bony shoulders, bad coloring, lifeless hair pulled back with a couple of plastic barrettes. Her fingernails were bitten right down to the quick. The wrinkles in her sweater suggested that she'd snatched it in passing from a pile on the bedroom floor. Both Rick and Sherry smoked. I introduced myself. "I'd like to talk to you, if you don't mind." Rick lounged in his seat, hooking his arm over the back of his chair while he checked me out. His legs were now extended insolently into my path. The pose was probably meant to look macho, but I suspected his waistband had jammed his stomach right up against his spleen, and he was affording himself some relief.
"I heard about you. You're that private detective old man Fowler hired."
His tone was knowing. Nobody was going to put one over on him. "Could I sit down?" Rick motioned me to a chair, which he kicked out with his foot. His notion of etiquette. I sat down. Sherry didn't seem thrilled with my company, but at least it saved her being alone with him.
"So, what's the deal?" he said.
"The deal?"
"Yeah, what do you want with me?"
"Information about the murder. I understand you saw Bailey and Jean together the night she was killed."
"What of it?"
"Can you tell me what happened? I'm trying to get a feel for what was going on." From the far side of the room, I saw Pearl's attention focus on our table. He extracted himself from his conversation and ambled over. He was a big man, so that even the exertion of crossing the room left him breathing heavily.
"I see you've met my boy and his wife."
I rose halfway from my seat and shook his hand. "How are you, Pearl? Are you joining us?"
"Could."
He pulled out a chair and took a seat, signaling to Daisy to bring him a beer.
"You fellas want anything?"
Sherry shook her head. Rick ordered another beer.
"How about you?" Pearl said to me.
"I'm fine." He held up two fingers and Daisy began to fill a jar from the dispenser hose at the bar. Pearl turned back to me.
They catch Bailey yet?
Not as far as I know.
Heard Royce had him a heart attack.
An attack of some kind. I'm not sure what it was. He's in the hospital now, but I haven't really talked to him.
Fellow's not long for this world.
Which is why I hope to wrap this thing up, I said. I was just asking Rick about the night he saw Jean Timberlake.
Sorry to interrupt. You go right ahead.
Not much to tell, Rick said uncomfortably. I drove by and spotted the two of them getting out of Bailey's truck. They looked drunk to me.
They were staggering?
Well, not that, but hanging on to each other.
And that was midnight?
Rick made a visual reference to his father, who had turned at Daisy's approach.
Could have been a little after that, but right around there.
Daisy put the two beers on the table and went back to the bar.
You see any cars passing? Anybody else on the street?
Nuh-uh. Bailey says it was 10 o'clock. I'm puzzled by the discrepancy.
Pearl intervened. Coroner put the time of death close to midnight. Naturally, Bailey'd like everybody to believe he was home in bed by then.
I glanced at Rick. He should have been home in bed himself.
You were how old? 17 at the time?
Who, me? I was a junior in high school.
You'd been out on a date?
I'd been at my grandma's, and I was on my way home. She'd had a stroke, and Dad wanted me to stay with her till the visiting nurse got there.
Rick lit another cigarette.
Sherry's face was expressionless, except for an occasional flicker of the mouth.
Meaning what?
She checked her nails and decided to give herself a manicure with her teeth.
Which was when?
10 after 12, something like that.
Pearl spoke up again.
Nurse on the early shift called in sick, so I had Rick sit in till the other one got
there. I take it your grandmother lived in the
neighborhood. Why all the questions? Rick asked.
Because you're the only witness who can actually put him at the scene.
Of course he was there. He admits that himself. I saw the two of them get out of his truck.
It couldn't have been somebody else?
I know Bailey. I've known him all my life. He wasn't any farther away than here to there. The two of them drove down to the beach, and he parked, and they got out and went down the steps.
Rick's eyes strayed back to his father's face.
He was lying through his teeth.
Excuse me, Sherry said. Does anybody mind if I bug out? I got a headache.
You go on home, baby, Pearl said. We'll be there in a bit.
Nice meeting you,
she said to me briefly as she got up. She didn't bother to say anything to Rick. Pearl watched her departure, clearly fond of her.
I caught Rick's eye again. Did you see anybody coming in or out of the motel?
I knew I was being persistent, but I figured this might be the only chance I'd get to question him. His father's presence probably didn't help, but what was I going to do?
No.
Nothing out of the ordinary?
I already told you that. It was just regular, normal.
Pearl spoke up.
You've about exhausted the subject, haven't you?
Looks like it, I said. I keep hoping I'll pick up a lead.
It'd be nothing more than damn luck after all this time.
Sometimes I can make luck, I said. Pearl leaned forward, thrusting his double chins at me.
I'll tell you something. You're never going to get anywhere with this. It's no point. Bailey's confessed, and by God, it's going to stick. Royce don't want to believe he's guilty, and I can understand that. He's near dead, and he doesn't want to go to his grave with a cloud hanging over him. I feel sorry for the old fool, but that doesn't change the facts.
How do we even know what the facts are at this point? I said. She died 17 years ago. Bailey disappeared the year after that.
My point exactly, Pearl said. This is old news. A dead horse. Bailey admitted he was guilty. He could have been out by now instead of starting all over. Look at him. He's taken off again. Who knows where? Doing who knows what? We might any of us be in danger. We don't know what's going through his head.
Pearl, I don't want to argue with you, but I won't give up.
Then you're a bigger fool than he is.
I just about had my fill of argumentative old men. Who asked him?
I appreciate your assessment. I'll keep that in mind.
I glanced at my watch.
I better get back.
Neither Rick nor Pearl seemed sorry to see me go. I could feel their eyes on me as I left the place, giving me the kind of look that makes you want to step up your pace a bit.
I walked the 2 blocks to the motel. It was just after 10, and two black and whites were parked side by side across the street. Two young cops were leaning on the fenders, coffee cups in hand, while their radio kept up a running account of what was going on in town. I kept thinking about Rick. I knew he was lying, but I had no idea why. Unless he killed her himself. Maybe he'd made sexual advances and she'd laughed him off. Or maybe he'd just been trying to look important at the time, the last man who'd seen Jean Timberlake alive. It was bound to lend him status in a community the size of Floral Beach. I took my keys out as I went up the outside stairs. It was dark on the second floor landing, but I caught a whisper of cigarette smoke. I stopped. There was someone standing in the shadow of the vending machine across from my room. I reached for the penlight in my handbag and flicked it on. Sherry. What are you doing here? She stepped out of the dark, the dim glow of the flashlight washing her face with white. I'm sick of Rick's BS. I moved to my door and unlocked it, glancing back at her. You want to come in and talk?
I better not. If he gets home and I'm out, he'll want to know where I've been.
He's been lying, hasn't he?
It wasn't midnight when he saw them. It was closer to 10. He was on his way to see me. He knew if his daddy found out he'd left his granny by herself, he'd get the crap beat out of him.
So what happened then? He left and went back?
Right.
He got back by the time the visiting nurse showed up for her shift. Later, when it turned out Jean Timberlake had been murdered, he said he saw her and Bailey. He just blurted it out before he realized how much trouble he'd be in. So then he had to make the time difference so he wouldn't get his ass whipped.
And Pearl still doesn't know? I'm not sure about that. He's real protective of Rick, so maybe he suspects. It didn't seem like it mattered once Bailey pleaded guilty. He said he killed her, so nobody really cared what time it was.
Did Rick tell you what really happened?
Well, he did see him get out of the truck and go down to the beach. He told me that at the time, but Bailey really could have gone back to his room and passed out like he claimed.
Why are you telling me?
It's no skin off my butt. I'm leaving him anyway, first chance I get.
You never told anyone else?
With Bailey gone all those years, who was I going to tell? Rick made me swear I'd keep my mouth shut, and I've done it, but I can't stand listening to any more bull. I want my conscience clear, and then I'm heading out.
Where will you go if you leave Floral Beach? She shrugged.
Los Angeles, San Francisco. I got $100 for the bus, and I'll just see how far it goes.
Is there any chance Rick could have been involved with her?
I don't think he killed her, if that's what you mean. I wouldn't stick with him if I thought he did that. Anyway, the cops know he lied about the time, and they never cared.
The cops knew?
Sure, I'd assume so. They probably saw her themselves. 10 o'clock, they're always down at the beach. That's where they have their coffee break.
Jesus, people in this town have sure been content to make Bailey the scapegoat. Sherry stirred restlessly.
I have to get home.
If you think of anything else, will you let me know?
If I'm still around, I will, but don't count on it.
I appreciate that. Take care. But she was gone.
Chapter 20. It was 11 o'clock when I finally eased into bed. Exhaustion was making my whole body ache. I lay there acutely aware of my heartbeat as it pulsed in my throbbing forearm. This would never do. I hauled myself into the bathroom and washed down some Tylenol with codeine. I didn't even want to think about the day's events. I didn't care what had happened 17 years ago or what would happen 17 years hence. I wanted healing sleep in excessive doses, and I finally gave myself up to a formless oblivion, undisturbed by dreams. It was 2 o'clock a.m. when the ringing telephone woke me from the dead. I picked up the receiver automatically and laid it on my ear. I said,
"What?"
The voice was labored and slow, low-pitched, gravelly, and mechanically slurred.
"You bitch. I'm going to tear you apart. I'm going to make you wish you'd never come to Floral Beach."
I slammed the phone down and snatched my hand back before the guy got out another word. I sat straight up, heart thudding. I'd been sleeping so soundly that I didn't know where I was or what was going on. I searched the shadows, disoriented, tuning in belatedly to the sound of the ocean thundering not 50 yards away, discerning in the tawny reflection of the street lights that I was in a motel room. Ah, yes, Floral Beach.
Already I was wishing I'd never come. I pushed the covers back and padded in my underpants and tank top across the room, peering out through the shears. The moon was down, the night black, surf tumbling in pewter beads along the sand. The street below was deserted. A comforting oblong of yellow light to my left suggested that someone else was awake, reading, perhaps, or watching late-night TV. As I watched, the light was flicked off, leaving the balcony dark. The phone shrilled again, causing me to jump. I crossed to the bed table and lifted the receiver cautiously, placing it against my ear. Again I heard the muffled, dragging speech. It had to be the same voice Daisy had heard at Pearl's when someone called to ask for Tap. I pressed a hand to my free ear, trying to pick up any background sounds from the caller's end of the line. The threat was standard fare, real ho-hum stuff. I kept my mouth shut and let the voice ramble on. What kind of person made crank calls like this? The real hostility lay in the disruption of sleep, a diabolical form of harassment. The repeat call was a tactical error. The first time I'd been too groggy to make the sense of it, but I was wide awake now. I squinted in the dark, blanking out the message so I could concentrate on the mode. Lots of white noise. I heard a click, but the line was still alive. I said, "Listen, asshole, I know what you're up to. I'll figure out who you are, and it won't take me long, so enjoy." The phone went dead. I left mine off the hook. I kept the lights off while I pulled my clothes on in haste and gave my teeth a quick brushing. I knew the trick. In my handbag, I carry a little voice-activated tape recorder with a variable speed. If you record at 2.4 centimeters per second and play back at 1.2, you can produce the same effect. That sullen, distorted, growling tone that seems to come from a talking gorilla with a speech impediment. There was no way to guess, of course, how the voice would sound if it were played back at the proper speed. It could be male or female, young or old, but it almost had to be a voice I could recognize. Else by the disguise. I unlocked my briefcase and took out my little .32, loving the smooth, cold weight of it against my palm. I'd only fired the Davis at the practice range, but I could hit damn near anything. I tucked my room key in my jeans pocket and eased the door open a crack. The corridor was dark, but it had an empty feel to it. I didn't really believe anyone would be there. People who intend to kill you don't usually give fair warning first. Murderers are notoriously poor sports, refusing to play by the rules that govern the rest of us. These were scare tactics, meant to generate paranoia. I didn't take the death and dismemberment talk very seriously. Where could you rent a chainsaw at this time of night? I pulled the door shut behind me and slipped down the stairs. The light was on in the office, but the door leading into the Fowler's living quarters was closed. Bert was asleep. He sat behind the counter in a wooden chair, his head angled to one side. The snores flapping through his lips sounded like a whoopee cushion, flat and wet. His suit coat was neatly arranged on a wire hanger on the wall. He'd pulled on a cardigan with cuffs of paper toweling secured by rubber bands to protect his sleeves. From what, I wasn't sure. He didn't seem to have any work to do, aside from manning the desk for late-night arrivals. "Bert," I said. No response. "Bert?" He roused himself, giving his face a dry scrub with one hand. He looked at me blearily and then blinked himself awake. "I take it the calls I just got didn't come through the switchboard," I said. I watched while the electrical circuits in his brain reconnected.
"Excuse me?"
"I just received two calls. I need to know where they came from."
"The switchboard's closed," he said. "We don't put calls through after 10 o'clock.
His voice was hoarse from sleep, and he had to cough to clear his throat. "News to me," I said. "Bailey called me the other night at 2 a.m. How'd he manage that?"
"I connected him. He insisted on that, or I wouldn't have done. I hope you understand about my contacting the sheriff. He's a fugitive from..."
"I know what he is, Bert. Could we talk about the calls that just came in?"
"Can't help you there. I don't know anything about that."
"Could someone ring my room without coming through the switchboard?" He scratched at his chin.
"Isn't any way I know of. You can phone out, but you can't phone in. Ask me, the whole business is a pain in the neck. Over at the Tides, they don't even have phones in the rooms. System costs more than it's worth anyhow. We had this one installed a few years back, and then half the time it's down. What's the point?"
"Can I see the board?"
You're welcome to take a look, but I can tell you right now no calls came through. I've been on duty since 9 o'clock, and there hasn't been a one. I've been doing accounts payable. Phone hasn't made a peep.
I could see a pile of envelopes tucked in the box for outgoing mail. I ducked under the counter. The telephone console was on one end, 18 inches wide, with a numbered button for every room. The only light showing was my room, 24, because I'd left my phone off the hook. "You can tell when a phone's in use by the light?"
"By the light," he said. "That's correct."
"What about room to room? Couldn't a motel guest bypass the switchboard and dial direct?"
"Only if they knew your room number."
I thought back to all the times I'd given out my business card in the last couple of days, the telephone number at the Ocean Street neatly jotted on the back. My room number, too, in some cases. But which?
If a phone's in use, you can't tell from the light whether a call is to the outside, room to room, or off the hook, right?
That's right. I could flip that switch and listen in, but of course that'd be against the rules.
I studied the console. How many rooms are occupied?
I'm not at liberty to say.
What, we have national security at stake here? He stared at me for a moment and then indicated with a put-upon air that I could check the registration cards in the upright file. While I flipped through, he hovered, wanting to be certain I didn't pocket anything. 15 rooms out of 40 were occupied, but the names meant nothing. I don't know what I expected.
"I hope you're not fixing to change rooms again," he said. "We'd have to charge extra."
"Oh, really? Why is that?"
"Motel policy," he said, giving his pants a hitch.
Why was I egging him on? He looked as if he was about to launch into a discourse on management strategies over at the Tides. I said good night and went back upstairs. There was no possibility of sleep. The phone began to make plaintive little sounds as though it were sick, so I replaced the receiver and disconnected the instrument at the jack. I left my clothes on as I had the night before, pulling the spread over me for warmth. I lay awake, staring at the ceiling while I listened to muffled noises through the wall. A cough, a toilet flushing. The pipes clanked and groaned like a clan of ghosts. Gradually, sunlight replaced the streetlights, and I became aware that I was drifting in and out of consciousness. At 7, I gave it up, dragged myself into the shower, and used up my allotment of hot water. I tried the Ocean Street Cafe for breakfast, downing cups of black coffee with the local paper propped up in front of me so I could eavesdrop on the regulars. Faces were beginning to look familiar. The woman who ran the laundromat was sitting at the counter next to Ace, who was getting ragged again about his ex-wife, Betty, seated on his other side. There were two other men I recognized from Pearl's. I was in a booth near the front, facing the plate-glass windows with a view of the beach. Joggers were trotting along the wet-packed sand. I was too tired to do a run myself, though it might have perked me up. Behind me, the customers were chatting together as they probably had every day for years.
"Where you think he's at?"
"Lord only knows. I hope he's left the state. He's dangerous."
"They better catch him quick, is all I can say. I'll shoot his ass if I see him anywheres around here."
"I bet he's got you peeking under your bed at night."
"I peek every night. That's the only thrill I get. I keep hoping to find somebody peeking back at me."
The laughter was shrill, underscored with anxiety.
"I'll come over there and help you out."
"Big help you'd be."
"I would. I got me a pistol," Ace said.
"That's not what Betty says." "Yeah, he's loaded half the time, but that don't mean his pistol works."
"Bailey Fowler shows his face, you'll see different," Ace said.
"Not if I get him first," one of the other men said. The front page of the local newspaper was a rehash of the case to date, but the tone of the coverage was picking up heat. Photographs of Bailey, photographs of Jean, an old news photo of the crime scene, townspeople standing in the background. The faces in the crowd were blurred and indistinct, 17 years younger than they looked today. Jean's body, barely visible, was covered with a blanket, trampled sand. Concrete steps going up on the right. There was a quote from Quintana, who sounded pompous even then. Probably bucking for sheriff since he joined the department. He seemed like the type. I wolfed down my breakfast and went back to the motel. As I went up the outside stairs, I saw one of the maids knocking on the door of room 20. Her cart was parked nearby, loaded with fresh linens, vacuum cleaner mounted on the back. "Maid service," she called. No answer. She was short, heavy-set, a gold-capped tooth showing when she smiled. Her passkey didn't turn in the lock, so she moved on to the room I'd been in before Bert had so graciously consented to the change. I let myself into room 24 and closed the door. My bed was a tumble of covers that beckoned invitingly. I was buzzing from coffee, but under the silver shimmer of caffeine, my body was leaden from weariness. The maid knocked at my door. I abandoned all hope of sleep and let her in. She moved into the bathroom, a plastic bucket in hand filled with rags and supplies. Nothing feels so useless as hanging around while someone else cleans. I went down to the office. Ori was behind the counter, clinging shakily to her walker while she sorted through the bills Bert had left in the box for outgoing mail. She was wearing a cotton duster over her hospital gown. Anne called from the other room.
"Mother, where are you? God!"
"I'm right here."
Anne appeared in the doorway.
"What are you doing? I told you I wanted to do your blood test before I go up to see Pop."
She caught sight of me and smiled, her dark mood gone.
"Good morning."
"Good morning, Anne." Ori was leaning heavily on Anne's supporting arm as she began to shuffle into the living room. "You need some help?" I asked.
"Would you please?"
I slipped under the counter, supporting Ori on the other side. Anne moved the walker out of her mother's path, and together we walked her back to the bed.
"Do you have to go to the bathroom while you're up?"
"I guess I best," she said.
We did a slow walk to the bathroom. Anne got her settled on the commode and then stepped into the hall, closing the door. I glanced at Anne. "Could I ask you a couple of questions about Jean while I've got you here?"
"All right," she said.
"I took a look at her school records yesterday, and I noticed that you were one of the counselors who worked with her. Can you tell me what those sessions were about?"
"Her attendance primarily. The four of us did academic counseling, college prep requirements, dropping or adding classes. If a kid didn't get along with a teacher or wasn't performing up to snuff, we'd step in and test sometimes, or settle disputes, but that was the extent of it. Jean was obviously in trouble scholastically, and we talked about the fact that it was probably connected to her home life. But I don't think any of us actually felt qualified to play shrink. We might have recommended she see a psychologist, but I know I didn't try to function with her in that capacity.